for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For nearly 13 years, Dominic Browning was editor-in-chief of House and Garden, a magazine with 950,000 readers. She'd spent 30 years climbing the publishing ladder and breaking glass ceilings. Then, one Monday morning in 2007, she was told to pack up and be out by Friday. The magazine was folding. Now in a new book titled Slow Love, she writes about the heartbreak of losing her job and the healing process of reinventing her life. Dominic Browning joins me in the studio. You can join us as well. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, Dominique. Thanks
for being
here.
Good morning, Diane.
Glad to have you here. Tell me what you're doing now.
I am writing my heart out. I'm writing for many different magazines. I have a story out in Wired this month. And most importantly to me, I'm writing a monthly column for the Environmental Defense Fund website. So I was delighted by your last program on this tragedy unfolding in the Gulf.
Now, the writing for the Environmental Defense Fund, it seems to me, is a perfect extension from House and Garden.
You are so correct. I think people who garden, people who love the land, are extremely connected to nature, and they see in their own backyards the effects of climate change, of global warming, and it wakes you up to the need to do something.
Tell me about your life as editor-in-chief of House and Garden.
My life as editor-in-chief of House and Garden was an extremely busy, structured life. I had meetings to go to all day long, advertisers to meet with, designers to consult with, architects, and I had a wonderful team of people working with me putting out the magazine. A magazine is a really organic, teamwork kind of project, and so I was busy all the time, morning, noon, and even night if I wanted to be. And it was a great job.
At the same time, you write that Condé Nast was a publication where the backstabbing was at the highest levels of management and it was elevated to an art form.
It was, but I have elevated denial to an art form, and I was able to create my own little bubble in the company, protect my people from that kind of talk, and I refuse to have that kind of talk in my offices. And, you know, we were a very happy, functioning place, productive place, and I had a long tenure at a company that is known for firing editors quite rapidly.
Now, you're saying that that backstabbing was at the corporate level, and you managed to stay separate from it.
Absolutely.
And were you aware that your own magazine was in trouble?
My magazine was a startup. Although House and Garden was 100 years old, it had folded once before, so we were starting up again. And I knew that we were in a very competitive atmosphere, and the company was also starting other shelter magazines at the same time. So I was certainly aware of what was going on politically. There's a fixed pie of advertising dollars, and we're all competing for the same money. So I knew that it was rough sledding.
And how much contact did you have with the people at the top?
I met with Cy Newhouse and with the CEO and CFO every month. I walked through the pages of the magazine and told them what we were doing, what we were planning to do, and they met with the publishers every month. So there was a lot of contact.
So before that Monday, did you know that House and Garden was going to go down?
No, I did not. House and Garden had a huge turmoil on the publishing side. We had 6 publishers in basically 12 years, and in 10 years, actually. And that kind of turmoil is very, very difficult to manage. I felt that where we were when we folded was at a much more solid place, that and we had a fantastic circulation and fabulous renewal rates. So I was quite surprised when we were folded.
Okay, so why were you folded?
We were folded for several reasons. One, another publisher quit. 2, the economy was starting to hit the skids. 3, housing was also in trouble, and our market, our advertising dollars had a lot to do with housing-related dollars. And as you see, 4, within 6 months, the entire publishing and newspaper industry were in free fall.
And so you feel you were caught up in that free fall.
We were caught up. We didn't have a stable enough foundation under our house. And when the free fall started, we slid into it.
So everybody in your office, and how many were there?
In our New York office, we were on the editorial side, probably about 40 people.
And around the country?
The publishing staff had a lot of people, and I don't know the numbers.
So everybody got a pink slip.
Oh, yeah.
On that Monday.
Oh, absolutely.
Everybody out of a job. Mm-hmm. Salaries ranged from what to what?
Salaries were ranging in the magazine industry standards. It used to be that Condé Nast paid much higher salaries than any other company, but I think that was not true. As of 15 years ago, they're competitive with Time, Newsweek, all the big magazine
what does
companies.
That mean?
So I would say salaries ranged from roughly $50,000, $60,000, or editorial assistants who made less than that, up into the mid 6-figure salaries, you know, the $100,000, $125,000,
$150,000 range. So for you, what did the loss of work mean financially?
The loss of work financially is enormous. It means that for the first time in my life, after 30 years of working, I do not have a regular paycheck coming in. Fortunately, even though I went to Condé Nast, where lifestyles are quite lavish, I never changed the way I lived. I never bought a bigger house. I never I never did anything different. So I was able to save money while I was there. Luckily, and not luckily, really through hard work and through savings, I have a cushion to fall back on for a certain amount of time. But I have to work, and I'm working really hard to keep money coming in.
You owned 2 houses, correct?
I used to own 2 houses. I sold one house because I could no longer afford monthly payments, taxes, things like that.
So you had the second house to fall back on?
Yes.
And so you were never without that basis of shelter or comfort.
Exactly. And my book, Slow Love, is not about falling into financial freefall. It's not about a financial debacle. It is about a psychological journey through the pain of losing the structure of work, although it could be the pain of any kind of rupture, into a path leading towards asking a lot of questions about, what am I doing here? I'm heading into the next chapter of my life. I have to reinvent myself. What's important and what isn't?
You know, it was interesting to me that there was a review, as you know, in the Washington Post last week that Carolyn C., a woman who does regular reviews for the Post, had written. She concentrated rather on a extramarital relationship that you had. Not that you were married, but your lover was married, still in his marriage. And yet you were carrying on this relationship that you really didn't suffer psychologically because you had him, you had this second house. I wonder how you reacted to that review.
I found that review to be completely irresponsible because it was completely inaccurate. And I do wish people who reviewed books would not review the writer, but would instead review the book and read it carefully and pay attention to the details. My friend of many years, yes, was married. And however, I have to emphasize, as I did in the book, he was legally separated. What that meant was that he was paying child support, alimony, had moved out of his apartment. His wife was given the apartment as part of their separation agreement. So this was a completely above board relationship out in the open. Everybody knew about it. We socialized together. We were out in public. This was not your classic sub rosa extramarital affair. So that's the first thing I'd like to correct about that review. The issue of not having being in a financial debacle, no, I am a middle class person, an upper middle class person who suffered a real setback. But I am not on the streets, and I am not on the streets because I worked really hard my entire life. And I am sick and tired of women having to apologize for having worked really hard, having saved their money, and being able to take care of themselves. We should be able to take care of ourselves.
Had your parents given you that lesson?
My parents gave me that lesson when I was a child. I've been working since high school, and I always had to take care of myself. I never got alimony. I was never given that kind of support when I got divorced, and I'm very proud of having been able to do that.
Dominique Browning. She writes a column for the Environmental Defense Fund. Her new book is titled Slow Love, How I Lost My Job, Put on my pajamas and found happiness. Short break, right back. And welcome back. Dominique Browning is with me. Her new book is titled Slow Love, How I Lost My Job, Put on My Pajamas, and Found Happiness. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's an email from Keith in Silver Spring. He says, sorry, but I can't sympathize with this woman. I'm more concerned with the clerical staff that's looking for work while this lady peddles her book. How do you react to that, Dominique?
I react by saying I am also concerned with the clerical staff looking for work. I'm concerned with everybody who is looking for work, and this cuts across all economic spectrums. People who lose their jobs go through a great deal of psychological difficulty. Exactly. You are mourning for the structure of your days, the reliability of having income, and probably supporting other people. So it's a big problem.
You put on your pajamas. Talk about that.
Well, I put on my pajamas. I also did as much consulting as I could possibly get, but as I pointed out, my industry was in free fall, and so that withered away. And but I put on my pajamas because that was comfort clothing. And I was writing more and more, so I was able to be at home in my pajamas. And it was just a way of trying to take care of myself while I was in this psychological pain.
At one point, you actually went out of the house in your pajamas. Did you realize what you were doing?
Sure, I realized it. I have a feeling more people are doing that than you realize.
Well, I can't. I really can't. But I wonder whether, in response to Keith's point, whether there are an awful lot more people at the clerical level who have a harder time reinventing themselves than clearly you have with your talent, your background, your history as a writer.
But you know, when something bad happens, whether it's the loss of a job, the loss of a loved one, a health scare, whatever it is, when something bad happens, you have two choices. You're either going to fall apart or you're going to not let it flatten you and pick yourself up and get moving again, do something. And that's finally where I came to. The desire to be back out in the world, to be moving again, to be doing anything I could be doing to reinvent myself.
Of course, I and you remember that Freud said the two most important things in life are love and work. And for you, love had gone or not by then?
Love was gone.
So you had the love of your son, who was just going off to college, but you did not have the love of your lover. So at the same time you lose your job, you have no lover, and your son leaves.
You know, what happened was that I hit my 50s, and it's as if the wheels came off the wagon. This relationship was going nowhere. I had a terrible health scare, and was very, very lucky that a doctor, completely out of the blue, noticed that I had a kidney cancer, which is an incurable cancer. And very fortunately, I was operated on and cured. So that happened.
Removed.
The kidney was removed, which is really the only thing
right.
You can do, because it is called the silent killer. There is no known chemotherapy for it. So I had a terrible health scare. And in terms of my family, I came to a very interesting place as the mother of two boys. They were no longer children. They had left home. I had the so-called empty nest, and I had to learn how to be a mother to adult children instead of to young children, which is, of course, what I still want them to be. So it wasn't just the loss of my job. That's what triggered this huge crisis for me, but it was looking around at the rest of my life and feeling, wait a minute, this is not where I want things to be for the next 20, 30, 40, however many years I'm lucky enough to have. 5 years, who knows? This is not how I want things to be. And I think this is a time in our lives, I think when you hit 50, you start to look around and think, okay, where am I going?
What about friends?
Well, as they say, when you run into trouble, you learn who your friends are. In some cases, I was shocked at how my friends disappeared and were not there.
Give me an example.
I had a friend who said to me, well, now you've lost your power, I can tell you anything I want, and proceeded to tell me what a bad person she thought I was.
Did she really mean it?
You know, who knows? I'm not her psychiatrist. I can't understand what it is. But I had friends who didn't call. And many, many people, especially people who have gone through cancer, have had that experience where they feel as though their friends might think they're contagious or something. People don't know what to say. They're afraid to say the wrong thing, or they feel shy, so they disappear. So, you know, you learn. And on the other hand, on the positive side, people I hardly knew stepped right up and were there for me and called again and again and became wonderful new friends.
What about invitations?
Invitations? Well, I took every invitation to dine that I possibly could. And again, some were forthcoming, and other people who had included me at their table dropped me.
That must have hurt.
Sure.
I mean, what did that feel like for you when, you know, clearly as the editor-in-chief of a magazine, you, I'm sure, had many, many invitations. What did it feel like for you when they were simply no longer there?
Well, in some cases, and in most cases, actually, it felt like relief because I'm not a very social person. I'm not a party animal. And I was very glad not to have to go to a million benefits and the things you have to do when you're in the kind of job I had. In the case of people who, you know, and I didn't, I knew who my friends were for the most part. I knew perfectly well when I was being included because of my title. These things are very clear in any kind of city. In the case of friends who stopped including me, it was very painful, and it really caused me grief, but you move on.
Did you confront any of them?
In some cases, I did.
How?
By saying, you have really hurt my feelings. Why haven't you included me? What's going on here? And, you know, in some cases, we were able to talk through it, and in other cases, there was just a level of thoughtlessness that I didn't want to deal with anymore.
How about siblings? Do you have any?
I do have siblings. I have two sisters and a brother, and my parents are both still living, and they were wonderfully supportive throughout all of this.
It's got to change your sense of self when, as you said, you've supported yourself for 30 years. You've broken through glass ceiling, reached the top of a profession, and then there's nothing. What happens to you inside initially?
Initially, I found it to be paralyzing because I was dependent on the schedule of my days to tell me what to do every day. What happened slowly over time was that I began to understand that I had a whole new way of life to approach and that I had to create my own schedule. I had to be responsible for giving myself reasons to get out of the house. I had to pick up the phone and ask for work, and I had to complete assignments that I could get by myself. So it reversed the way I was in the world. And of course, initially, when something like that happens, you feel as though you don't have a purpose anymore, or I certainly did, because work was what defined my days. I worked through my having children, through raising my children. I've always worked, and I've always supported myself, and I still support myself.
And your ex-husband, where is he?
He is the dean of Columbia Journalism School and has a lovely new family. And he was present when this happened and called and reached out with ideas about what to do.
Was supportive.
Absolutely.
All right. We've got lots of callers waiting. We'll open the phones 800-433-8850. First to Dee in Water Park, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. And first, I wanted to say that I've been a longtime admirer and supporter of Dominique. I have two of her other books and was a longtime subscriber of the magazine and was shocked when the magazine closed. And also am a freelance writer for Interiors Publications. Mm. So she has been, you, Dominique, have been an inspiration to me in writing and just, you know, in your life.
Thank you.
And my question is that I read the review that was recently done about your book in the New York Times book review, and I thought it said that there was some, getting back to the backbiting and in that industry in general, that the editor of Architectural Digest had evoked some type of a boycott against advertisers of House and Garden after the magazine closed.
It was against designers who had participated with us. And
yeah,
and it was very difficult because, as you write about it, the design community does not have big marketing budgets. These are usually people who are working on their own or in small shops. And they depend on shelter magazines to get the word out about what they do, what their vision is, what their style is. So I believe that all of it should be very open. There's plenty of work to go around for all magazines. But other people don't have that opinion.
Okay, it makes it perfectly understandable now. So there was a boycott against designers who had been featured in the magazine.
Right.
Oh, that's terrible.
I agree.
Unbelievable.
Happens a lot, does it, Dominique?
It does happen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but my bottom line about this is bad karma out, bad karma in. You know, the world will move around and people will find other ways to get the word out of their beautiful work.
Dee, thanks for calling. We'll
go now
to Jeffrey, New Hampshire, and to Regina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Regina.
Yes.
Yes, I just feel a great bond with Dominique because I kind of went through the same thing. When I was 44, 2 years ago, I lost my job. I was the main breadwinner in our family, and basically we lost two-thirds of our income, and I have two young children, worked from home. So I completely lost my identity. and I also felt that when that happened, there was a little understanding from some people about that. For example, one of my friend's husband said, well, what's the big deal? Your husband's working. Well, yes, but he was also supplementing our income, and it just seemed like there was not an understanding of the great, you know, the bigger picture here. We own two houses. I had to sell one of them. We had to move my children into another school system. And also, I felt my husband started treating me differently because I wasn't Big Mama bringing home the bucks anymore.
It's tough. That's really tough. It's a really hard thing to go through. I've started blogging at slowlovelife.com so that I could continue the conversation I started in the book. And I cannot believe the numbers of people who are writing to tell me that they've been through things like this.
I feel like I'm coming out of a nervous breakdown.
Right.
Is that how you felt too, Dominique?
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
You know, I'm an educated person. I have great background. I couldn't get a job, so I'm going back to school in September to be a teacher. So I feel like I'm coming out of this, but it's been a long process, and it's just been, you know, I know I'm one of the lucky ones because I've had other options, and if it wasn't for my husband, his job, I'd have to sell both of my homes, and I don't know what would happen to my children, but...
But, you know, we make our luck. I really believe that. You know, you are lucky, but you also worked hard to get what you have and to get to where you are. And we make our luck. And then the other thing that I think is very important to understand here is that this period of lying fallow, of being quiet and trying to figure out what next, can be a very productive time. It sounds great that you're going to start teaching. I'm delighted to be writing for Environmental Defense Fund. It's a whole new chapter. It takes a whole different part of your life and your soul and your brain. And you're going to look back in 5 years and say, wow, I was really lucky that happened.
Regina, thanks for calling. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Michael on Martha's Vineyard. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. This is Michael. Diane, we're a huge fan of yours here at WCAI Woods Hole. And Dominique, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. And I hope I'm attributing this story to you correctly, but wasn't one of your first letters from editor about some coworkers that had driven out to your backyard and were sort of complaining about your outdoor furniture, and you responded to them?
I forgot that, but you are right.
Oh,
yes.
I love you. I've always attributed to you. I love that. I think it was one of your very first letters from the editor, and it said so much because you're stepping up and reversing something was otherwise sounds like that sort of catty Condé Nast behavior, and addressing it up front and recognizing the great American mass-produced mid-century, you know, furniture. I thought this is a woman and an editor that I want to follow because I want to hear what she has to say. So isn't that funny? That was a while ago, but.
Tell me the story, Dominic.
Well, you know, I came to House and Garden from way outside the design field. My background was at Texas Monthly, Esquire, Newsweek for many years. So I had a very different kind of background. When I came in and got the job as the editor of House and Garden, nobody knew who I was in that world. And I think they wanted to figure out who is she and what kind of values is she bringing to us. So somebody did actually drive out, and I only heard about it by mistake. They drove out to the suburb in which I lived and drove up my driveway, because you can't see my backyard from the street, and looked inside over the fence to see what my garden looked like. And there in the garden were some pieces of outdoor furniture that I had picked up at a flea market that were from the 1950s, and of course that cost nothing. And this was before the big boom in 1950s furniture. So at a party, a friend of mine was sitting next to somebody who was telling the story about how he drove up and what kind of person is this and what's her taste like, and it's going to be the end of the magazine before it even begins and all that. And of course, it came back to me. It's a very small world.
Wow. You know, people really have their own ideas and create their own images, even though one may be right in front of them. Dominique Browning, her new book is titled Slow Love.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant at Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the Aetna Foundation, committed to improving health, wellness, and access to high-quality, affordable care for everyone. Learn more at aetnafoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, John Powers is just back from the Cannes Film Festival. We'll talk with him about the winners and why this year's festival felt less like an extension of Hollywood than in years past. Join us.
And here's an email for Dominique Browning from faraway Belgium. Listening over the internet, Bogdan says, I have a couple of words for your guest. As a man, I am impressed not only with your ability to pick up and move forward, but also with your ability to speak so frankly about it in the book and on the air. It's inspiring to see someone who's facing problems face on rather than blame their misfortunes on others, encouraging and inspiring.
Thank you so much.
Indeed.
That's wonderful.
All right, let's go now to Greenland, New Hampshire. Good morning, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi, Dominique. I just wanted to say how much I have enjoyed reading you over the years. You are an absolute inspiration, and the way you wrote your letters each month would send my mother and my sister and I into hysterics. They were so personally written, so lovingly crafted, and you used to wrap up the end with some beautiful little anecdote or lesson, whether it was about a couch you couldn't decide, you know, which one to buy, or your son moving out and leaving for college, or recovering from the divorce, or buying your house in Rhode Island. I'm from Rhode Island, so I could relate and sort of envision your situation. It was always exciting to hear from you every month, and we looked very much forward to getting the letter. And when we discovered no more letter, we all called each other and said, "Why didn't Dominique call us?"
I know. I felt such a bond with my readers. I would get an amazing response in letters. All those columns are now up on my website at DominiqueBrowning.com.
Terrific.
There's an archive for
Terrific.
Those letters. And, of course, the blog at SlowLoveLife.com continues that kind of conversation. I wrote those letters because we were publishing a magazine full of beautiful rooms and perfect gardens, and I wanted to tell readers, hey, I know that life is not perfect, and it is full of conflict and sadness and joy and happiness and confusion. And I wanted to tell readers why I thought this was such an important subject.
Dominique, one of our earlier callers mentioned that her husband's attitude toward her changed. What about your son's attitude toward you?
You know, it was a very interesting process for my children to go through my losing my job, because, of course, at first they thought, oh, well, you're just going to get another job immediately. But that's kind of what was happening with the publishing industry. There were no jobs for me to get immediately. My younger son in particular, who is 21 years old, at the time was 19, and he kept saying to me, "Mom, what is the point? You worked so hard your whole life. You gave it everything you had. You were so busy and so involved with your work, and then look what happens. They fire you. You're gone. They don't take care of you. What's the point of working so hard? Why should I think about working so hard?" And, you know, of course, our kids are facing joblessness rates,
totally.
Headlines about how bad things are out there. You know, we have to think about, what are we doing to our children? What kind of world are we handing over to them? And it took me a long time to be able to say to Theo, honey, the point is not the undoing, the point is in the doing. I had a great time. Whatever I was doing, whatever job I had, I loved it, and I had a great time, and I gave it my all. And if it ends, for whatever reason, that's not the point. You have to focus on what you were able to do.
And what you will continue to do in some new way, perhaps a different way, but nevertheless, that you don't give up and stay in your pajamas.
Well, or you figure out a way to work in your pajamas.
Which is a great idea as well. Let's go to South Central Missouri. Good morning, Vicki. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, ma'am. Lovely show, lovely pertinent program. This is my show. I am a nurse who... Well, I was going to be terminated around age 50, and I see this to be a trend for a lot of people because of retirement issues and money and pensions and also health issues, because I am having health issues. But I just wanted to let you know that on the day that I was to be terminated, I actually gave them a letter of resignation, which blew them away, because I told them I didn't want to be that kind of nurse and do that kind of work. And I am changing my life. It has been a stunning situation, very mind-boggling, and I am 50, I have a child, I am single, I am surviving with the help of unemployment, thank you, American government, and I have had time to think about things that I never had time to think of before because I was so caught up in the rat race of the healthcare system and how it exists and how they plug you into computers and run you and run you and run you ragged in a basement that's understaffed and undersupplied and disconnect from people who run and manage these healthcare systems. And I have been able to garden and do the things that I can do. Got disabled on the job, and now I am gently and slowly recreating a beautiful place for myself and my
that's
son.
That's wonderful. And you know, the health issue is a really big one. When I had this kidney cancer and had the surgery, I threw myself back into work almost immediately. I went back way sooner than the doctor said, way too soon. And in retrospect, after I stopped working, I realized that I was running away from some very large questions, such as, what is the meaning of life? What does it mean that you are mortal and you could die at any time? What does that mean for how you fill your days, the kind of spirit you have, the kind of energy you have? I didn't want to think about those things. I didn't want to think about mortality. So part of, I think, what's going on now, and it sounds like for you as well, is that you realize, hey, I've got to think of some fundamental issues here.
Vicki, good luck to you. Stroller, the gentleman you talk about in the book, was not very supportive when you went through that kidney cancer.
No, he was not. And again, you know, I have a lot of friends who say, oh, well, men are like that. They can't handle hospitals. They can't handle illness, whatever. You know what? In my life, I don't want men who are like that. I want men, including my own boys, who are there by my side through thick and thin.
Let's go to Charles. He's in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I just wanted to share a similar experience. I was a top editor like Dominique Browning in New York for many years. And being an editor, of course, you're always serving other people. In a sense, the other people, the writers and artists and so on, come first. And the hard part for me when I lost my job in similar circumstances was that suddenly I was confronted with serving myself, having to suddenly say, wait a minute, now what I do, because I have all this freedom of which I'm the only master. And then one day I woke up and said, my goodness, this feels terrific, because I never had that kind of freedom at the magazine. I was always a quite willing slave to the job. That's really all I have to say about it at the moment.
Well, you know, it is true. I mean, as an editor or as any kind of manager, really, no matter where you're working, you are taking care of other people constantly. I was always taking care of writers and taking care of, and I felt responsible. And I'm a big sister, so I brought that big sister personality to my work. It was sort of shocking to realize that I had to start taking care of myself and that nobody was taking care of me. And I had to learn. I actually had to learn to pick up the phone and call friends and say, I need help. The hardest thing for me to do.
What about looking for a job?
That was really hard. I had a lot of success in getting jobs for the people who were working for me. But for me to get a job, I just had a really hard time. I got some wonderful consulting projects. I worked at the Wall Street Journal and helped them reinvent their Saturday section. I worked at New York Magazine for a while, but there were no jobs forthcoming. And then I started writing. And as I said, I started this work with the Environmental Defense Fund, and I'm passionate about the environment. And I think that global warming is the biggest crisis facing our world and facing us and our children. So I started doing something that I felt passionate about and that I felt was really important.
Here's an email from Holly, who says, thanks for your wonderful guest. I have empathy for her journey. I congratulate her for saving money to bridge her job loss and being prepared to take care of herself. Brava. Question, does she miss the action? I, too, am 50, female, lost a powerful-ish job 18 months ago. I have a consulting job, but I miss the action. How does she handle it?
You know, I totally understand that. I miss the action, too. I missed also having my team of people around me. That is what I am loving about the internet and about blogging. I feel like now I've got colleagues, people who comment, who come back to the blog day after day. I know who they are, some of them now, through their persona online. And I feel like I'm developing a kind of virtual community. And I'm also trying to make an effort to reach out to some of the editors who are giving me assignments and trying to see them face to face and that kind of thing. So yeah, I miss that kind of personal contact, but I'm figuring out other ways to bring it into my life.
To Fred in Greenbelt, Maryland. Sorry, it's Fran in Greenbelt, Maryland. You're on the air.
Good morning, ladies.
Morning.
I just want to share some points with you, and I want you to understand something. I want you to look at what's happened to you in a broader perspective, because it's happening to every human being on the face of this earth. All of us were conditioned in the school to be part of the master-slave environment. We're the slaves, and we work for the masters. All of that is changing. This is all these crises of being got to get a job, J-O-B. J-O-B means just above broke, okay? That's not who you are. It doesn't define who you are. We have institutions that teach people that, yes, it is, because you equate your dollars and values and stuff. That type of mentality will cause people to spiral down in a nosedive and commit suicide. What you are doing is you are breaking free from all of those constraints, those things that did not define who you are. Yes, they were interesting pursuits, but they weren't who you were.
You know, the whole idea of who you are is a fascinating subject, and I sort of disagree about work and the importance of that. But I think work has a lot to do with who you are. It has a lot to do with your values, what you're able to give, what you're doing, what you're producing. It makes you feel like a productive human being. So I disagree with that.
Dominique Browning, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Pardon me. I've just had a voice treatment, and it's not back yet, Dominique, but I'm glad I'm here this morning. Here's an email from Michelle in Dallas, Texas, who says, I've been hearing about this book. I'm pulling into a bookstore right now to buy it. I want to read her story so that I can help my husband, a CEO who lost his job 9 months ago. He turned 50 shortly thereafter. Like your guest, we are financially capable of weathering this storm through hard work. She says, I am a CEO too, but my husband is devastated and uncertain of his future. His work has been a major part of his life. For those who denigrate your guest because of her affluence, please know it is every bit as hard for executives as for clerical people to cope with the devastation of career loss.
You know, I have to say your husband is one lucky person to have somebody like you in his life. The idea that you are pulling off the road because you think there might be something that is going to help understand what he's going through is so moving to me. And I think that's what a lot of people have said about the book, that they feel it helped them understand friends who were going through it. You know, a lot of times when people are depressed, we want to say, oh, just snap out of it. Pull yourself up. Get going again. Get over it. Get over yourself. Whatever. You know, for whatever reason. And we have to understand that that doesn't actually help. It makes things worse. And that there are other ways to deal with situations like this.
Of course, there are millions of people without work out there, and also without the means to be able to carry on.
And it's terrible. It's really, really, really difficult. You add financial anxiety or devastation to psychological devastation, and it is really, really rough.
How do you think you've been changed, not only by the experience, but by writing about it.
Writing has been a wonderful way for me to think through what I'm going through, and it also has been a way for me to reach beyond my own situation to something that is more universal. And all writers have the experience of writing across economic boundaries. You know, we don't write just for each other, we write for other people. And when you write, you try to get to the heart of something that cuts across all kinds of differences, and you try to reach to something more universal and express it for people.
And I think that what we're hearing this morning, with the exception of that very first unsympathetic email, is the idea that people are cheering you on, Dominique.
Well, and I'm very touched by it, and I appreciate all the support. Thank you, everybody.
And the fact that you will continue to do your blog, you'll continue to write for the Environmental Defense Fund, and you'll continue to earn a living. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dominique Browning, her new book is titled Slow Love, How I Lost My Job, Put on My Pajamas, and Found Happiness. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.